There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Now, you're no stranger to being in front of the mic, are you, James?
No. In fact, the irony is that in the other show I do on Nightline on Wednesday nights, it's James and James again.
So here we go. Well, it's James, and Annabelle.
This is going to get really confusing.
Yeah. The two J's squared and an A.
Equals.
Yes. Equals fun.
That's so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, you guys. I am a professor down at UAU University, United Arab Emirates University. Clearly, I am from North America. And I have a podcast, a forthcoming book author in the spring. So I have a ton of stuff going on, and I'm a dad of four. So
busy man.
Yes.
I'm impressed you made it out to us today. I really am.
The warden let me go. I'm just kidding, hon. If you're listening to this, that is not true at all.
So being stranded on a desert island, is that, you know, a punishment or or a holiday for you?
Just catch me at different times of the day and I'll have different responses. It would be a punishment overall. Okay. Yes, yes.
So you've been asked to just bring three books with you. Was it hard narrowing it down to three?
It was kind of hard because the reality is that I tend to end up falling into a lot of business books, which really isn't as fun to talk about from a fictional standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then because I'm my mid-30s, early 30s, I read Harry Potter. That was like a book a year. So So in some ways, it was really hard, you know. And there are a ton of great books out there. And so to say like it's this or that is tough. So I kind of just went with what resonated personally the most with me, and that's how I selected them.
So which ones nearly made the list? I'm always interested in that.
So the near one was the Harry Potter series, just because I think that's genius the way she evolves it over the eight episodes, seven books. I went to the TV series, went to eight movies, over the six. Another one on top of that, gosh, that was tough for me. Because I ended up doing, like I said, a lot of business books. So we'll talk about one of the business books later on. But, you know, I just started reading another one by Marshall Goldsmith, which is an internationally well-known leadership guy. So this is not an easy question for me. And plus, I always have to go back to getting my PhD at one point, four kids. Time just kind of gets eaten away from me as I go. So I'm bad at that answer. I apologize.
Speaking of business books, aren't you working on a book of your own?
I am, and thank you for the plug that I will shamelessly do later on my own. I have a book coming out in the spring called Crucible's Gift, Five Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity. And it's really predicated from my podcast, Executives After Hours. And what the podcast is really about is I take you on a journey of these leaders. Now, I've interviewed leaders all the way from Fortune 2 companies all the way down to entrepreneurs and so forth and so on. And my tagline is, I care who you are, not what you do, because who you are defines what you do. And so throughout these interviews, I started coming up with themes that kept really arising again and again and again. And the premise, just over the top really quick, is that what I found is that the leaders that had the largest and most significant impact, people around them, had this thing called the crucible. And they used the crucible, that moment of adversity, to turn it to a positive. So many of us have something that happens to us, and we actually reflect inwards of the negativity of it. And many of them, not initially always, went back and looked at it and saw what the positives of it and how that changed their compassion, integrity, ability to relate to others, their self-awareness. But the only way they did all of that is because they had a growth mindset. And so I kind of marry this all together into a nice little simple model and thrown it out there in the spring.
Excellent. So it's people who can find the silver lining, quite literally.
Yeah, no, literally. And it was amazing to me the amount of CEOs. And I can show you a story with one of the books we're going to talk about today. He had a crucible. And that crucible totally changed his perspective on a concept. And that changed who he was fundamentally as a person and how he leads and how he manages and how the impact that he actually has in the organization.
Yeah. Now, that's the third book that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And we're going to kick off with a little bit of fiction.
Yes.
So what's the first book that you're taking to your desert island? Because I gave the little John Cusack teaser.
Yes. I loved it. Did anyone get that? You know? No? Yes?
I actually haven't managed to get the text up on my screen yet. So
that one's been a bit fidgety with me over the last few weeks as well. So
yeah, technical difficulties, guys. Yes. Apologies.
So listen, this book for me, I was on a Nick Hornby just tear in my late 20s, early 30s. And this book fundamentally impacted me as a person and my perspective that I had on relationships and on myself being kind of the consistency of the problem when you think about it. And that book is really about John Cusack coming to terms with his own, the grass is always greener. Not John Cusack, obviously.
Yeah.
But that's the way I think of it, firstly. But about the main character's significance of him always thinking the grass is greener on the other side. And I feel like that's life's motto, right? It's always better from looking at the other side. And I'm totally blanking out on the main character's name in that book. It's so bad of me.
So am I as well, which is really awkward. Yeah. The thing that resonates the most with me, and this is a little bit random, but it's his lists. It's the constant making of lists.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that's human nature, right? Like, where do we fall in a pecking order? And so those lists are all about, you know, it's all about the character trying to say that there's always a first and there's always a 10. It's always a best 10 list, right? And so, you know, the ability to say that there's a pecking order means that you're evaluating everything for its good and bad. And evaluating everything that's good and bad means you start losing sight on the greater good of something. And so the underlying theme is that he does rank everything, you know, gives it a list, different titles of lists, different types of lists within a different type of list. It's really fascinating how he breaks it constantly down. But it's really a metaphor for him as a person and all of his struggles he's had, because he's really trying to find love at the end of the day. And trying to find that love is something that he wants, but he's bad at, right?
Incidentally, we've got the name of the character. Don't worry, it's Rob Fleming.
Thank you.
There we go.
Thank you
to James, James 2, for putting us out of our misery.
You know, and the book obviously was Americanized, right? Or the movie was Americanized from the book, which is based in the UK.
Yeah.
Did you see the movie first or read the book?
Read the book first. So I can say that. I can say that, but unfortunately... So in my early 30s, late 20s, I lived in San Jose, and I had a DVD player, no cable, and I had two movies, Gladiator and High Fidelity. And so I had no friends there at the time, because I had just moved there. So I literally had those two movies on repeat. So now High Fidelity and John Cusack and then Russell Crowe and Gladiator are just forever etched in my mind.
Well, if you only had two movies, I'm not surprised you didn't have any friends.
Yeah. I would say that's a low blow, but there's some truth to that probably. So,
if you've just tuned in, we are talking to Dr. James Kelly about his Desert Island Reads, the first of which is High Fidelity by Nick Hornby, an absolute classic. If people aren't familiar with what this book is ultimately about, if they've never picked up this classic before, how would you describe it to them? And who would you recommend it to as well?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think the description is really about a guy, again, who's on this journey of trying to figure out why he keeps failing at relationships, and especially the particular one that he was so in love with her, right? And then he goes off and cheats with her, and then he has to, like, unravel what happened there. And so I think it's for individuals who, first of all, like the real story. Like, for me, it hit home because I was in a phase in my life where I couldn't seem to hold a girlfriend. I couldn't figure out why, you know? And it was just this kind of aha moment for me, like, I have the grass is always greener syndrome. And when you have the grass is always greener syndrome, you're always looking at that grass thinking how great it is, and I want to be on that side of the fence. And sometimes in relationships, you know, I've been married 10 years now. Sometimes in relationships, you know, especially when you're young, you're really trying to sort out is what's love versus passion, right? And how do you break those two apart? Because love is very different than passion, very different. And it's trying to discern and break those down and have a better understanding. And that's what the book ultimately comes to the conclusion of, is that passion is the immediacy, love is forever, and understanding the different sense of that emotion.
Have you read the book, Annabelle?
No, and I've been trying to get hold of the book for ages, mm-hmm. and I've been persuaded so many times to watch the film by people, and I've managed to say no for ages because I'm still trying to get hold of a copy of the book. And honestly, I think I'm cursed because every time I go into a bookshop and try and buy High Fidelity, they have every other Nick Hornby except for that one.
Well, you guys realize, though, you don't actually have to get the physical book. There's this crazy thing called Amazon
I don't have a Kindle.
Right.
That you just look so disappointed.
It does. You're very Renaissance, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I ask that is because I find that this book is a divider of the sexes.
Mm.
This is a book which men will read and men will enthuse about. And generally, if a woman has read it, she'll look at it and, I'm not saying all women, but many women will go, so what? I don't get it. What is all this about? I don't see why it's funny. This guy's a bit of a nerd. He just needs to shape up. It's one of those books that really, I'm not putting them on a par, on a literary par, but it's a Jane Austen moment. So women will talk to you about Jane Austen and will enthuse about Jane Austen. Men will read Jane Austen. They'll say, that's great, but I don't really get it. I don't know. Is it one of those books?
So I actually think it's about framing. Mm-hmm. So if you can explain to a woman that it's an insight into a man's thinking and irony, then in that, there's... I see cringe over there.
Annabelle's about to hit us.
Yeah, yeah. And this is like hurting her head. But like, you have to think about it, right? Like it's about taking. I always say, look through other people's lenses, right? When you're trying to create compassion. So if you really want to understand a man, have some compassion, read it through that lens. Someone's going to punch, like, reach through this mic and punch me at some point.
We're very lucky this is being broadcast in a room that's closed off.
But there are pads on the wall, so really.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I look at it. I mean, I think that's James is agreeing, so... I think we're
From what I've read in terms of like, because I did do my research on this, I did look at quotes and I've seen the trailer so many times, I got, oh, I need to actually get my hands on this book at some point. And from what I've seen of it, maybe it's because I really like John Cusack, I don't know, but this does seem like my kind of book. And I do like it, the dark side of his humor and everything that I've seen in the quotes as well. So I do think that I will like it and I will defy your branding of this as divisive between the sexes. I do think that that's going to happen. So thanks for sharing your first book with us, James. You cannot escape the desert island just yet, so put on your sunscreen. We'll be right back with more Desert Island Books after this.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So you've got three books with you. Do you have any survival instinct as well? I'm interested to know whether you would actually survive on a desert island.
I would feel, I mean, if I had like the Wilson-esque thing to talk to, like from Castaway, I think I would be all right. Because, you know, I grew up the youngest of four, and I'm the youngest by 5 years, and I had two parents that worked full-time, weren't the healthiest people, and inevitably, I was just kind of by myself a lot. So I got pretty comfortable early on being stuck in my own head. So you figure you just you know, multiply that by 1,000. It can't be that much worse. Like, so
you'd be in your element, really.
Yeah, maybe. Is that sad? Does that sound sad to you?
Not really, no.
No.
I think you sound comfortable with your own solitude.
Yes, it's a great way to put it.
So the first book that you shared with us was Fiction. It was High Fidelity by Nick Hornby. And the second book you've got to share with us is actually a collection of essays. It's nonfiction.
Yeah.
Tell us what you've brought with you.
The second book, which, excuse me, I think is just great, is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line by Ben Hampers. You and I were talking offline ahead of time. He hasn't done any work besides this, really. And he is amazing in this book. If you haven't read it, it really is an insight to life on an assembly car assembly line in Detroit. He worked for General Motors. He wrote about it. And he had this amazing ability to tell you a narrative that was so vivid about a very simple task that he did again and again and again, and how he weaved his life around it.
And he was very close to Michael Moore. In fact, Michael Moore was the guy who brought him to prominence, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's surprisingly, I didn't actually know that until Annabelle told me. Like, I literally picked up his book randomly one day and just started reading it. Like you two are avid readers. I am a practicing avid reader, where I want to be more avid, right? And so for me to pick a book up and read, it has to grab me within the first 15 pages. If it doesn't, it's really hard for me to keep going. And this book does it straight away. And I read this book 20 years ago, and it still resonates with me in terms of the narrative that he tells in the first person and the stories around it.
What were the stories in particular that appealed to you? The ones that really struck out?
So, you know, I had to go back and reread a part of this book. And I think what really sticks out is just how he talks about the stuff that he would have to do on the assembly line, like come up with his own set of Olympics, right? Kicking washers up into the rafters, or how far you could spit, or like just whatever they could do to break the monotony, because that was really what the book was about, was how do you actually get through a shift doing the exact same job again and again and again without losing your mind, which many did. Right. And at one point in the book, he talks about how him and his partner were on the same job, and they figured out how they could do the job where one could go to the bar and drink and the other one could sit there and do both jobs at the exact same time. And they would just rotate days and maybe get time and a half because they had to stay late. And so they had this scam to get paid to just go someplace else and not actually be on the assembly floor.
So they were playing the system. Basically.
Totally. Yeah.
There is actually a tenuous link to High Fidelity here. So we were talking about the fact that he, since this book, he hasn't really written much else, has he? He's kind of a one-hit wonder. in the literary
world. Yeah, maybe in choice too.
Maybe in choice. So how this all started and the connection with Michael Moore was that he sent an unsolicited record review to an alternative paper called The Flint Voice. This was before that he wrote Rivethead. And The Voice's founding editor was Michael Moore, who obviously is director and producer of Fahrenheit 9/11, if the name sounds familiar. And he saw something in Hamper's writing and asked him to write more. And specifically, he said, what Ben really should be writing about is what he and a lot of other people in this town were going through every day, which is simply going to the factory.
And now that you mention that, I remember the paper that he was writing for before he wrote the book. So thank you for that memory rattle.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, it's interesting because he's the third generation of a family that have gone, you know, that have worked within the plant. So if you look at his grandfather was really part of the authority, a real believer, if you like, in GM and ended up very wealthy. Mm-hmm. Then his father went and worked there, and then you got to him, and he is really the antithesis of what his granddad was. You know, he's making fun of it. He sees the drudgery in it, and it's almost like a tale of the American dream gone wrong.
No, I think that's an absolute fantastic insight. You're way smarter than I am, by the way. On that note, though, what's also interesting is he also thanks his grandfather for him having the opportunity to have this job. Mm. This isn't what he wanted, but in default in life, I think when you come up in certain socioeconomic environments, and this science behind this, right, that says that your zip code will dictate the likelihood of your success. And so in his mind, being raised in a blue-collar environment, the expectation was, this is what you're going to do. It wasn't a matter of working on the assembly line. It was a matter of which car company you were going to work for on which assembly line. And that to me is the interesting thing, is that there was a level of acceptance reluctantly by him that was going to be his life. You know, and you can see the dismantling of his life in terms of the drugs and the drinking, divorced, I mean, all sorts of problems persisted for him and those around him.
Speaking of, you know, what this is about and all the problems that he had, you know, somebody who's talking about being on the front line of industrial capitalism, you'd expect the language of all this to be quite dark, quite pessimistic, but there is a sense of humor with it, isn't there?
Oh, man, it's total humor. That's what got me. You know, because I think humor is a way to people's heart. If you can use humor and irony to relate to someone, for me, it's easy to read that book. Because once it's relatable, then it's a transaction between you and the author at the end of the day. Like, he's telling you a story and you're kind of engrossed in it and you don't mind reading it. You don't mind being part of it because you can see aspects of your life in that. I mean, I would imagine for both of you, some of the best books that you've read, there's an aspect of you seeing part of your life in that book. Would that be a fair?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, not all books.
Thankfully, not all books.
Maybe some of us might be more depressed about their life than others, but for me, you know, that's one of the things that I loved about this particular book at that time. You'll see a theme, High Fidelity, the next book we're going to talk about in this one. It was a moment in my life where I had a serious reflection and impact on some of the choices that I made moving forward in terms of my attitude. And I think this was just another book of where, when I read it, I was kind of doing a task that I wasn't happy with. And you can read this book and see how his life plays out, and you think, man, that's awful. That's sad. Is that what I want? But he does it with humor, which then, you know, it's almost as if he realizes that he should be doing something else. And it's the sadness that it's self-deprecation. It's probably the word I'm looking for. And he's able to use self-deprecation as a way to shed light on a situation that is sad for many people.
I'm interested in the process of you choosing books. I mean, you seem to be able to choose books at a certain point of your life that just resonate.
Don't ask me these questions.
What did you choose last week?
I actually just downloaded 2 leadership books because this is obviously the journey I'm on. You know, right now I'm on a particular journey personally, and so now I'm really, you know, on this. I have a task, like, you know, I have Christmas holidays coming up. I want to consume X amount of books about a particular topic. So I have a method, which I'm happy to share with you guys, but I know we got to run.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So you've had High Fidelity by Nick Hornby as your fiction book. You've had Rivethead by Ben Hamper. Mm-hmm. And what's your third book that you're taking with you?
It's Solve for Happiness. Solve for Happy kills me when he says that. Solve for Happy by Mo Gadot.
Now, when did you first come across this book?
When I interviewed Mo for my podcast, to be honest with you. And Mo is actually local. which most people don't know. He actually is based in Dubai. So yeah, that's when I first came about it. We had a chat about it, so I was forced to read it before I talked to him, which was great.
I have a big heads up as well. I don't know if you're aware, but he is actually coming to the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in 2018.
Awesome.
So from the 1st to the 10th of March. He is up there on our emiratesliterfest.com website. He's one of the author names there. So if you have, after listening to this chat, questions for Mo, if you're inspired, you want to find out more, do make sure that you head to the website, find out a bit more about him and about the festival. So what is it about Soul for Happy that intrigues you so much?
Well, I think, as James wisely pointed out, it's at a point in my life where there's the significance of a journey that I'm on particularly. And so this concept of being happy is really important. As you get older and you realize that you vacillate drastically, and why is that? And is it a state? Is it a moment? Is it, what is it? And so I'm on this personal journey of trying to figure out what happiness means for me, and to be more in that state versus that, I guess, that ebb and flow of it, you know? And so that's the book kind of resonates with me quite significantly.
One thing that I'd like us to talk about a little bit, though, is, I don't know about you, but the number of self-help books that I see about the concept of being happy.
Sure.
I don't think that this falls in that category at all, because often I find these self-help books tend to go with a lot of vague platitudes. Just, you know, you will be 100% happier if you do this one thing, or nothing seems to be very concrete, very, very spelled out. Mm-hmm. And I think this is perhaps what sets Mo Gaudat apart from all these other people.
I think that it speaks to his engineering background.
Yeah,
And he's very clear on that's why it's Soul for Happy, because he wanted to come up with an equation that for him made it easy to understand. And he goes into, it's a very big book. He goes into a lot of details about this process and how he came to it and what it means and what you can do to solve for your own happy.
And also, Mo Gaudat's background, you mentioned engineering, but he's on the Google X team. Do you guys know what Google X does?
Yeah. Google X is amazing. So Google X is basically Alphabet, which is the parent company now of Google, does all of the moonshots. So every crazy idea that they have at Google goes to Google X, and Mo is the chief business officer of that. And so he kind of goes out and helps execute this. So one of the examples is in Africa. They put balloons in the sky with Wi-Fi, so people can actually get internet access in the middle of nowhere. So these are ideas they try out to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and how can you then essentially scale it up to mass. And that's one of his major jobs. And the other thing that I really love about not only Google X, but Mo particularly, is if you ever meet him, he is the most humble, down-to-earth person that you will ever meet, who takes nothing for granted and is always in the moment. And he could easily have used his power and wealth to be in a position of authority, if you will. But you don't get any sense of that from him whatsoever. And Mo, if you are listening, give me some money or some sort of feedback.
Well, he's got two Rolls Royces still sitting in the garage, which he bought on a whim. And so he could give you one of those.
Yeah. Well, I would gladly take that.
Going back to the Rolls Royces, I'd like to establish a little bit of a timeline here as well, because if you look at Mo's past, 2001 was when he was buying all this stuff, these Rolls Royces, but he was desperately unhappy. And he had this moment where he thought, you know, he would approach this like an engineer would. He would tackle the problem like an engineer. And eventually, after countless hours of research and science proved successful, he discovered the equation for permanent happiness. But then 13 years later, a terrible thing happened, and his algorithm will be put to the ultimate test. And rather than me tell you all about that, I think it's so much better coming from Mo himself. So listen to him as a speaker. He's fantastic.
To lose a child, I know those of you who have children will know, is the hardest thing ever. It's until today I struggle to understand what it really means. I struggle to understand the exact feeling that I'm feeling. I just don't have words for it. There is no other event in my life where I felt the same way. And there was every reason to be miserable, to be honest, when we lost Ali. But we were not. We were okay. I wouldn't say we were happy, just to be very specific, but we were peaceful. We spent the next few days, being visited by friends until his memorial, where we had thousands of people who would walk in sad, crying, and we would hug them and explain to them what we understood about happiness, what we understood about death and life, And they would smile and go around our house looking at pictures of Ali smiling all over the walls, and you know, and they would leave happy. And if you didn't know the background to the event, you would have thought it's maybe Ali's birthday or something. Most of my friends came to me and said, you should probably write this down. It resonated very well, and it's clearly working. So I looked at the book as the model, but the businessman that I am, and with my love for Ali, I sort of set myself a bigger mission, if you want. I gave myself a target to try and make 10 million people happy. And, you know, while it doesn't bring Ali back, I sort of felt that if we can share Ali's model with 10 million people and make them happy, then the world is a slightly better place.
That's Mo Gawdat talking about the heartbreaking event that led him to writing Soul for Happy, which is the book that we are discussing as part of Dr. James Kelly's Desert Island Books today on Castaway. When did you find out about this? Like, did you know his backstory before you read the book?
I did not. So I had one of his PR agencies reached out to me to be on the podcast, and he said, here's his book. I didn't know who this guy was. And you just start reading his story, and it just starts to unfold. You know, he did the ultimate thing of chasing happiness through financial gatherings, right? We want stuff, more stuff. And the more stuff I get, the happier I'm going to be. And what he realized is the more stuff I got, the more miserable I was. And in that, he realized there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way to approach life. And that, to me, again, resonates because we're all on this journey in life, right? There's no destination. The only thing we're ever assured of is that we're going to die and that change is going to happen inevitably. And what he does is he figures out how to be happy within the inevitability of life in itself. And I think that's the biggest message. You know, and to your point earlier, he really does break it down. And if you know, I tend to be a big audiobook person because just I'm on the go. He actually narrates the book himself and does an amazing job through theatrics as he's going. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, you feel like you're in the room talking to him as he's sharing the book with you.
We've had a couple of text messages come in. Prachiti says, Mo's book is absolutely a must read. The reason he wrote the book is his son. He's a lovely person, and it's a perfectly engineered book for happiness. I love that phrase, perfectly engineered book for happiness.
Yeah, I think we'd agree with that. What did he come up with? What is the algorithm then?
So I'm gonna paraphrase it in a way that doesn't do it justice, and I want to say that ahead of time. But basically for him, what he realized is that happiness is plus or minus your own expectation. So where you start off with is going to determine if you're happy or not. So if you have huge expectations, you're most likely going to be disappointed, right? That's what it essentially comes down to. And he found a way to manage that process in his mind. And one of his biggest things is just be in the moment, right? He has several chapters about this concept of just being now. And it's very Eastern philosophy-esque. But if you're in the now, then you're not worried about what is or is not happening to you. You're just present. And that's impactful when you really think about how many of us are waiting to talk or waiting to do something else versus listening with intent. And that's one of the fundamental things from the book.
Does he give you tips on how to do that, or the practical tips?
Yeah. He has a whole bunch. He's an engineer. He has to give you steps inevitably no matter what. And so throughout the book, he gives you exercises to do, things to think about, activities to write down. So it's a whole how-to book. I mean, it's really a blueprint on how to be happy.
I'm really glad that he does take it step by step, because, as I said, I'm so tired of people coming out with these books that are just like, you will be happy if you do this one thing, or just be happy, visualize your happiness and everything will be fine. Like, no, it's not that easy. If it were that easy, everyone would be doing it, surely.
Yeah.
But what you just said about, you know, managing your expectations versus, you know, reality as part of the algorithm for happiness and Soul for Happy. And the first thing I think of is, you know, anytime you remember a great evening or moment with your friends, it's usually, in my case anyway, it's usually the ones that are unplanned or the things that you didn't plan, rather than, say, like the big parties that you put all this time and effort into and you had these massive expectations for.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, just one sidestep from this is that expectations is only one part of his equation. I mean, so I just want to be clear on that. There's a whole other set of things that goes into it, you know, comparing, negative self-talk. You know, it broke, but I was on this journey of happiness. I actually had a rubber band on my wrist. And every time I would say something negative about myself internally, that dialogue, I would actually snap my wrist, because I'm trying to recondition myself to think positively and frame things differently in a positive way.
That sounds painful.
Momentarily, but I think the important thing is that it's teaching me to create a new behavior. in terms of how I think and how I act. So
every time you had a negative thought, you would snap the rubber band on your
negative thought, or, you know, as a dad, sometimes you're a bit overly terse that you don't necessarily need to be, and the tone that you have isn't necessary to get the point across. I would do it then. Yeah, I want to leave my kids at least better than me, better than how I am at that age, how I was at that age, how my thoughts were at that age. And luckily, my wife is a saint and comes from a saint family. So for them, they're lucky to have her as a mom that kind of gives them a role model about how to act and how to treat human beings. I'm not saying I'm some awful human being, don't get me wrong, but I want to make sure that I give them the same respect. And I think often we forget to do that with kids. So for me, Mo's book kind of gives me a framework of how I can become more happy, but also treat other people with that type of respect as well.
Just to recap before we wrap up, what books have you taken to your desert island? Books 1, 2, and 3.
Book 1 is Rivethead. Book 2 is High Fidelity, though it's very timely. And then book 3 is Solve for Happy by Mo Gadot.
And what connects these three books for you, choosing them on your desert island?
I think the theme is very clear. It's very situational in my life and where I'm at that point. And I think for many of us, we like to read books that tend to be where we're at in that moment.
When can we expect your book out, by the way?
April 23rd will launch.
And what's it called?
It is called, I almost said Mo's name. The Crucible's Gift, 5 Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity.
Okay, and that'll be by Dr. James Kelly, who's been a wonderful castaway guest. You are released from the desert island, James.
Thank you.
You okay? You got a little bit of minor sunburn.
It's minor sunburn. And really, the kayak that I came in, I patched the hole, and I'm slowly leaving now at a slow pace.
Okay, you came better prepared than most people.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.